It's a terrible old cliche to say that somebody needs no introduction. Which usually is a prelude to a terribly rambling introduction. But in this instance, it's absolutely true. Mr. Brian De Morse, or Sir, as I still think of him, is St. Michael's to many of us. So it's a great pleasure to ask you to speak to us tonight.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, it's very much more my pleasure to be here. And I'm going to start by something I very rarely do, and that is to make a promise. So I will tell you what that promise is. I shall not mention a motor car. However, we had a very entertaining article in the Current magazine about Ian Burton, the Archimandrite. And he told me, well, told both of us, particularly because my wife is well speaking, he told us this story. You may have heard it before, I don't know. He was much troubled, and he was a very good linguist, and he did look a bit of an odd character with his black habit and his flowing grey hair and huge flowing beard and whatever. And he was in Paris on the occasion of a Wales versus France rugby international. And some few yards behind him on the pavement were some Welsh-speaking rugby enthusiasts who had probably had a can or two too many and were making extremely rude remarks about him. Well, he completely took the wind out of our sails by turning round and talking them to Welsh, in Welsh, and giving them a really tough ticking off that absolutely floored them. Now, I'm going to move to a character that you probably, I'd take a pretty high bet on it, that none of you know, although you will have seen his name. And if you look in the history of St. Michael's that was written by Alderson and Collis and published in 1943, there is a list of organists. And in 1917 is a gentleman called Carlton Borrow. Now, I'd never heard of him. I'd seen his name, of course, in the list. I'd never heard of him. But fate was to decree that I had a great deal to do with him in later life. I knew when I had matriculated and taken my OTC certificate at St. Edward's, Oxford, I had 18 months before the Navy would want me or would take me. So I had 18 months to fill in somehow. I won't bore you with the first job I had for 6 of those 18 months. I can only say that it was exceedingly boring and I loathed it. Well, my father was a much troubled and very erudite parson, as his father had been before him. And he still took the Church Times after he'd retired from his last living. And I was just casually scanning through it, as one does, and there was an advertisement. I don't remember the precise wording, but it said, "The London Choir School requires an assistant master with musical training. Apply so-and-so and so-and-so." Very fortunately, the London Choir School had by then been evacuated to Kent. It was on the declivity that goes down from Seal Chart, which is about 3 miles from Sevenoaks, I suppose, towards the valley in Kemsing. And you looked across to the North Downs. Well, my favourite aunt lived in Seal, so that was no problem. So I presented myself for interview with Mr. Carlton Borrow. And he said, "Where did you get your musical training?" I said, "St. Michael's College, Tenbury." He said, "Right, the job's yours. Start in a week's time." Well, I don't suppose I say that any of you know the first thing about Carlton Borrow any more than I did until then. But he was a very entertaining character. He founded the London Choir School, which was housed in London, I'm ashamed to say I don't know where, and it was evacuated to Kent during the war. Now, before the war, they only had boys. They didn't train lay clerks or anything like that. They had three choirs of 12 boys each. And they had a tremendously good reputation because Carlton Borough took them on an extended American tour twice before the war. And you didn't fly across the Atlantic in those days. It was the old steamship job, which meant they would have had to be away for a month, 6 weeks or whatever, and touring around the United States. And they had a very high reputation. Well, the time came, of course, when they were forced to go from their London headquarters, and they were evacuated to this beautiful Elizabethan manor house in Kent, which had been owned by Lady Rhonda. Now, whether she voluntarily allowed the school to take over or whether she was booted out in that way that people were during the war, going, hop it, somebody more important than you wants to get there. But it was great fun. Now, we still kept the three choirs. Carlton Borough was organist at Christ Church Lancaster Gate, which was one of the choirs he had to supply every Sunday. The other one was Holy Trinity Brompton, which was under Canon Brian Green, who had a huge reputation as a preacher. And I'm ashamed to say I can't remember what the third one was. And as well as that, we would be in great demand for posh weddings in the Chapel of the Savoy or the Guards Chapel before it was bombed, and, well, you name it, anywhere, more or less. So we would have to troop up from Kemsing, walk to the station, get a train up to London. The trains were very uninteresting. They were all electric. So nothing interesting there. So three of us, Carlton Borough himself, and a very cheery Welshman by the name of Cecil Roberts, not the well-known author of that name, and myself, we would take a choir each and trundle up to London by train, which occasionally could be a bit dodgy in wartime, air raids and that sort of thing. So you didn't always get back just exactly when you wanted to. But anyway, that's how the system worked. And there weren't any commoners as such at the London Choir School in its evacuated form. Now, another connection which I heard of long before I actually ever met him was that Edward Pyne had been on the staff at the London Choir School before they were evacuated, and he was a great hero to them. I heard a lot about him in a moment, little thinking that I would meet him at St. Michael's, you see. And he was doing that, of course, before he went into the RAF. We had, as you can well imagine, wartime prep schools and choir schools and so on had to make do with people who were either too old or unfit for military service or something like that. They were a pretty polyglot lot. And we had an extraordinary fellow. He was an Irishman from what I call the right side of the border, which is not an Ulsterman, but a southern Irish. And his name was McGilligot. Now, at that time, there was a great deal of spy fever about. And McGilligot, extraordinary man, used to go out and walk around the Kentish lanes at night. And we were all sure he had a torch and was flashing to the flashing to the German planes overhead. Nobody ever proved anything, but he was a strange fellow. And then, to pass over a few years, I was in the Navy, and when the Navy came to tell me that they would like to kick me out, they did give me the option of staying in, but I said, no, thank you, I've got other ideas. I came down to St. Michael's, an appointment with Buckmaster, who had been a naval chaplain. He had, in his youth, been a cadet at Dartmouth, and he experienced a sort of on the road to Damascus conversion and became ordained. And when he was appointed warden at St. Michael's, he was, I think, the youngest warden we'd ever had. He was a great fellow, and I could go on about him quite a lot, but I won't. Anyway, that's how it was. We had these strange people who people believed all sorts of funny stories of, and it was quite a nice, happy existence. Well, I went down by appointment. I knew I was up for some leave, and I knew when the Navy were going to release me. So I went down by appointment with Buckmaster, and he appointed me as an assistant master and outer or counter tenor lay clerk. That was fine. And he said, so we'll see you, he said, beginning of September. Well, it was more or less the middle in there. It was about the 21st of September, something like that. The term used to start. I thought, that's great. Well, come the 21st or whatever it was of September, I'd saved up enough petrol to be able to drive down from Beaconsfield, where I lived at the time, and blew me if when I got there, no Buckmaster. He'd gone back into the Navy. He had married, he had married the daughter of the Vicar of Holy Trinity, Stratford-on-Avon. And she was a very pretty girl, and she'd been a wren during the war, and she'd sworn to herself that the one thing she would never do is marry a parson. And of course she found herself doing exactly that. And when she came back to St. Michael's, she found it so quiet, and she couldn't stand the peace and quiet, and liked a bit of a rackety life. So she persuaded Buckmaster to go back again into the Navy as a chaplain, which he did. So when I came to join, Buckmaster had gone, and well, that's really the end of the story. Thank you very much.